From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. No one bats an eye when we use money to buy food or clothing. We'll chat with an expert who thinks the same process should be used for buying kidneys and other more controversial transactions. The head of North Carolina's court system believes the state could benefit from criminal regulation reform. You'll learn what he's talking about and why. North Carolina has rebuilt its rainy day savings account in recent years. Now an expert recommends that lawmakers adopt clear rules about when that saved money can be spent. And we'll ask how a case challenging election maps will affect the North Carolina General Assembly in 2017. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
In less than a month, Democrat Roy Cooper will be sworn in as North Carolina's next governor, replacing Republican Pat McCrory. Cooper will face a Republican-controlled General Assembly and a cadre of statewide elected officials pretty much split between Democrats and Republicans. So what does this all mean for the new governor and public policy in 2017 and beyond? Joining me with a look at all of this, all of the challenges and the policy, is Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Well, we finally have received the ultimate decision. We had that a few days ago, but it's a very slim victory for Democrat Roy Cooper after many challenges by the Pat McCrory campaign. Where does all of that stand? Was there indeed any problem with the vote in North Carolina?
Well, some slight amount of voter fraud was uncovered. It was fairly minimal, and it wasn't enough to be election deciding as far as we can tell right now. Now, as we're recording this, Republican Chuck Stuber is asking for a recount in his race against Democrat Beth Wood for state auditor. Beth Wood has about a 6,000 vote lead over Chuck Stuber, and since the margin between the two is less than 10,000 votes, then the trailing candidate can ask for that. So we'll see if there's anything to that recount and if that makes anything change. But there were two counties in particular that were focused on. One was Bladen County, one was Durham County, and two completely different challenges. In Bladen County, the challenge had to deal with a person who allegedly was witnessing absentee ballots and possibly even filling them out, because in this a race for, I think, Soil and Water Conservation District Commissioner, the winning candidate noticed that on the ballots, some absentee ballots, there was a write-in candidate named Franklin Graham.
Interesting.
Interesting.
I presume not the Franklin Graham that we all...
Well, who knows? But anyway, Franklin Graham was written in on some 70 ballots in the handwriting that was very similar. So it looked like the same person was filling out these ballots. And that caused the State Bureau of Investigation to take over this particular race and the handling of it. And so that remains unresolved at this point. But if indeed the same person was doing that sort of thing, a witness can help a person complete a ballot, but the witness is not supposed to actually write, fill in the ballot for the voter. And so if the person involved here is actually found to have done this and is criminally charged and convicted, then there could be some jail time involved. Now, that was Bladen County, and that involved 70 votes. So that's not a big number of voters.
But over in Durham County, the question was about many, many more votes.
Right. It was. 94,000 votes were called into question by Thomas Stark, who is an attorney who is a resident of Durham County and who's the general counsel for the state Republican Party. And he was questioning the handling of these 94,000 ballots from, I think, five or six precincts in Durham that were reported very late on election night. Durham County was very late in reporting its totals, and before it reported the totals, Governor McCrory was ahead of Roy Cooper. When the report came in from Durham County of these 94,000 ballots, all of a sudden it flipped, and Cooper was in the lead, and it was a lead he never relinquished. And Thomas Stark was saying there were possibly some problems in the way these ballots were handled, some problems with the election machines, issues about whether or not the machines were properly shut down and guarded after the election was over. And that went through the state board, through the Durham County Board of Elections and the state board of elections. But the ultimate resolution was that not many votes changed.
Can we feel comfortable in North Carolina based on what has occurred that there was not massive voter fraud in our state?
Pretty much so. I mean, there was a third element that I'll get into in just a moment. But the thing that I think was highlighted from this was that Durham County was using election machines that were about 20 years old. And they were essentially equipped to handle the volume of ballots that Durham County was producing back in the mid-90s, but Durham County has grown since then. And so there's a very good argument that Durham County needs to invest in improving and expanding its technology, because that was what seemed to be the problem in Durham, was that simply the machines didn't have enough memory to handle the volume of ballots that were run through, and that's why they basically just sort of went offline for a while. They sort of shut down. Now, the third issue was one that was brought up by the Conservative Civitas Institute in a federal lawsuit, and that was dealing with same-day voter registration, which was something that was required by a federal court. The General Assembly had tried to remove it from voting laws. The court reinstated it, and Civitas was worried that people who registered on the day they were voting were not being verified properly, that there were not procedures in place to make sure that somebody just who already had registered in one place was registering someplace else and voting multiple times. And with the concession of Governor McCrory, the Civitas lawsuit has been withdrawn. But we did some sort of informal research here at Carolina Journal, just called some elections boards and asked what their procedures were. And their basic procedures were, if someone registered to vote at the same day they were voting, then they, of course, had to leave a valid address and the like. And there were a series of up to three mailings that went to that address. And if any of those mailings were returned, then the vote wasn't counted. And we found out from surveying a few counties that the rate of return was basically zero. So that there was not at least an organized effort to bring a lot of people to the polls and vote fraudulently. Now, of course, it's always possible that some would do this, but it didn't look like an orchestrated campaign.
Rick, I can recall during the debate over requiring a photo ID to vote in North Carolina that there were some critics of that who said, folks, you're looking at the wrong problem. Their contention was that absentee ballots and handwritten ballots, you know, and this going door-to-door issue that was encountered with Bladen County and mm-hmm. those questions, that was where there was really the potential for fraud. Would you predict going forward that we're going to have folks really looking much more closely at that?
Well, that was part of the multiple protests that were filed by the state Republican Party in some 50 counties had to deal with the flow of money from the state Democratic Party to various local political action committees that were basically get out the vote efforts. Turns out the one in Bladen County may have been problematic, but there were a number of other counties in which the state Democratic Party essentially gave money to a local political action committee. These are quite often African American dominated PACs that were responsible for getting people to the polls, getting them registered. And it looks like there wasn't a discernible pattern of any issues with potential voter fraud with these other counties. But in Bladen, there certainly was one. And that's one area that's going to be looked at, is to basically, I mean, follow the money, if you will. It's where are political parties, campaigns, even interest groups investing their money, and are they doing so in a legitimate way? You've got legitimate get out the vote efforts from, you know, nonprofits and unions and employee groups and things like that. But then you have these others that are more difficult to monitor, and that's going to be an issue going forward.
Now, come January, Roy Cooper will be sworn in as the next governor. He won the race by a little more than 10,000 votes, so he will be taking office, but he's going to be having to work with a Republican-controlled General Assembly, supermajorities in both houses. Can Cooper get anything done for Democrats?
Part of it depends on how he approaches things. If he does so in a very confrontational manner, he may have difficulty. However, there's another issue that's involved here, and that is how aggressive is the General Assembly going to be in trying to restrain the power of the new governor? One thing that the John Locke Foundation has talked about repeatedly, and did so during the McCrory administration, was the notion of making it more difficult for administrative agencies to enact expensive regulations without some sort of accountability.
Of course, Carolina Journal will be reporting on all of this. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When is it wrong to buy and sell? How about when it comes to your vote, or a kidney, or bets on terrorist attacks or natural disasters? Our next guest has an interesting approach to answering those questions. Jason Brennan is a professor at Georgetown University's Business School. He specializes in politics, philosophy, and economics. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So people do have sort of an interesting approach to when it is okay or not okay to be involved in commerce or to sell things. Your approach is something that is probably provocative to people from all different perspectives. Tell us how you approach this question.
So what my co-author Peter Jaworski and I are trying to show in our book Markets Without Limits is if you can do it for free, you can do it for money. So there are things that you shouldn't sell, but there are things you shouldn't do anyway. So one shouldn't sell child pornography or assassination services or stolen goods, because those are things one shouldn't have in the first place. But otherwise, our view is if it's permissible to do it for free, then the exchange of money doesn't introduce evil into the world where there wasn't any to begin with.
So let's put this into a concrete example, something that someone might find controversial to buy and sell that you think is okay.
Yeah, so take kidneys. I like always ask people whenever I'm giving a talk on this, how many of you have donated a kidney? No one ever has. So then I say, well, one thing I know about you is you're not kind and caring enough to save other people's lives for free, even though almost everyone I talk to is healthy enough that they could do that. Then I'll ask them, well, would you be willing to give away a kidney for, say, $50,000? And roughly half of people would. So as an economist, we'd say, aha, we have a supply curve. The higher the price, the more people who supply it. And then I think, would you be willing to buy a kidney for, say, your children if they needed it and that's the only way to get it? And most people would. But the government sets the official price of a kidney at $0, which means that there's a big shortage. People don't supply it. And in the U.S., the shortage is 100,000 people per year. Right now, there's 100,000 people on the wait list, and the vast majority of them will never get a kidney. They'll either die or get too sick to get a kidney and fall off the wait list.
Another example that we mentioned in the lead-in was a vote. What's your approach to that?
Yeah, so most people think it's kind of strange. If you don't know anything about voting at all, you don't know anything about politics, and you go and cast a vote for the worst possible candidate and you do it for free, people think, oh, that's great. That's to be celebrated. But if I were to call up my buddy Lauren Lemaski, who never votes but is one of the world's leading political philosophers, and ask him to vote his conscience and say, you know what? I'll pay you $50 to vote your conscience. People think that's evil. So my view is there's an ethics to voting. There are good and bad votes, and there are ways people should vote. But as long as you're voting in a responsible way, it doesn't really matter that you're getting paid to do it. In the same way that, you know, we don't think that firefighters have to donate their services, or police officers, or military people have to donate their services. Why think that voting is inherently wrong to be sold?
We are chatting with Jason Brennan, a professor at Georgetown University's Business School. Some people are going to be listening to us. The alarm bells are going to go off and they'll say, wait a minute. I understand markets and buying and selling, but things like voting and things like kidney, that's different. That's different. We should not have buying and selling of these items. Why are they wrong?
Well, I think most of the time when people have an objection to these things, they're not really worried about the market itself. They're worried about contingent features of the market that we can remove. So take kidney sales again. A lot of people will say, okay, well, hold on. I'm worried that desperately poor people will sell their kidney for too little money. And I can say, if you really think that, well, first of all, if they're that desperate and that's their best option, you take it away from them. You're not really helping them out. But if that doesn't convince you, I can say, well, what about making a law that says you can sell a kidney, but only if you make, say, over $30,000 a year, so we don't exploit the poor? Or somebody says, I'm worried that people will rush into selling their kidneys without knowing what they're getting into. Okay, well, how about you have to take a test? You have to be licensed to sell, and the test requires you to understand the costs and benefits. Or someone might say, well, I'm worried that desperately poor people won't be able to afford a kidney if they're priced on the market. And first of all, right now in the US, only rich people get kidneys. It turns out that there's supposed to be a lottery. It doesn't actually work. Only rich people get kidneys. Poor people never get them. But even if that weren't the case, we could, you know, some people can't afford food. We don't decide to nationalize food production or make it illegal to have a supermarket. Instead, we have food stamps. So maybe we could have kidney stamps as well. Now, I'm not necessarily in favor of any of those regulations, but the point is that if you are someone who's averse to kidney markets, those regulations should take care of the problems you have with them.
People who are down the line libertarians, I could see them hearing what you're saying and saying, yes, okay, this obviously makes sense because this is just not interfering with people's freely made transactions. But there are a lot of people who have sort of a libertarian sensibility but say some parts of our society and lives should be off limits for this. How do you make the case to these people who say, you know, I'm just kind of queasy about putting these things in market settings?
Yeah, it's true that most people feel revulsion, literally revulsion. When you look at the language that people use to describe these markets, they say they're ugly, tawdry, nasty, disgusting, vile. They use this visceral language. And at some point we have to ask, how good is your stomach at discerning morality? But people say things like, buying and selling kidneys inherently shows disrespect for the human body. It communicates disrespect. It's to treat the human body as a mere thing. And then I have to start to wonder, well, is it written into the fabric of the universe that to buy and sell these things shows disrespect for the human body? Or is it maybe just a way we happen to think about money and we can start asking, is there a better way to think about money? If I were to extend my middle finger to a person, that would show disrespect. But suppose we learn the following. When you extend your middle finger to somebody, it causes strange vibrations in the air. And those strange vibrations end up killing cancer in people. We would then change the meaning of giving the finger. We'd make that like an informal salute. We'd walk around giving people the finger all the time. Well, I think the meaning that we attach to organ sales is in a sense destructive. We treat it as if it's the sacred thing, and the result of that is that lots and lots of people die. So maybe we should revise the meaning we attach to the body rather than forbid the market.
You touched on something I think does probably play a major role in this, and that is even among people who are of a conservative nature, there's the same sense that there's something about money and the involvement of money in a process that dirties it or makes it somehow not completely ethical. Is that a major problem with dealing with these issues?
I think so. And one thing that was surprising to me, usually I'm using the language of economics and people expect that, but I did a lot of research for this book, and to my surprise, the sociologists were the people that came to my aid here. So sociologists have gone all over the world studying how people think about money, and it turns out that the view that Westerners have of money is just a kind of contingent view that we've only had recently and we didn't always have. So for a typical Westerner, regardless of whether they're left wing or right wing, they regard money as this profane thing that only has utilitarian purposes, and to put a price on something is to say that it's merely of instrumental value. But in the rest of the world, and even in the West in other times in history, people didn't think that way. So there are parts of the world where after you have sex with your wife, you are required to give her money, or failing to do so would be disrespectful. There are parts of the world where to give a money gift is seen as more respectful and more caring than to give a so-called thoughtful gift. There are parts of the world where people put prices on all sorts of things, and failing to do so would be seen as disrespectful. And I think maybe the way we think of money as this dirty utilitarian thing is the problem, and that's the thing that has to go.
Do you hope that this book will help people look at money in a new way and look at these transactions in a new way?
Yeah, I do hope so. And we try to be very careful in the book in going through all the objections people have to these markets, just methodically going through them and sort of saying, here's what your objection gets right, but here's how to handle it. And even what does money mean and why would economists think it's okay to put prices on things? And it turns out if you really understand economics, the idea of pricing things is compatible with the idea that some things really have sacred value. There isn't actually a conflict there, despite the claim that people think there is.
All right. The book's title once again?
Markets Without Limits.
And its co-author is Jason Brennan, professor at Georgetown University's Business School. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Does North Carolina need to re-examine the penalties it assesses in connection with state crimes? A recent state legislative committee meeting raised that possibility. The conversation started with Republican State Representative John Faircloth.
We have 37,000 people in prison right now.
Yes, sir.
And I dare say it would be hard to disagree with me if I were to say some of those folks have probably paid enough debt. They probably have been, we've done as much for them as we can where they are in that box over there with the bars around it. We probably could do a lot more as a society if we could get them outside. Now, how we get to that point, that's our challenge, obviously.
Marion Warren directs the State Administrative Office of the Courts. He responded to Faircloth.
I think what you're actually talking about is criminal regulation reform. Looking at penalties and right-sizing them, not being soft on crime, but looking at existing penalties and applying them correctly to the right cases instead of creating a new classification every time a unique problem happens. We are turning our criminal code into a writ-based system instead of a code that makes sense and can be applied by both prosecutors and the courts, and the defense attorneys can understand their options when they explain their cases to their client. A prime example, we have 14.99, which is embezzlement by a state employee. Right below that, we have 14.100, which is obtaining property by false pretenses. The penalties for the amounts embezzled or taken are exactly the same. Why do we have two laws beside one another? Why do we want to create, and another anomaly from my perspective, let's go down to district court. If you sell a child a pack of cigarettes, the penalty for that selling that child, meaning someone under the age of 18, a pack of cigarettes, is greater than if that very same child somehow comes into possession of drug paraphernalia or the marijuana that the paraphernalia would be used for. It's a class 3 for less than 1.5 ounce. It's a class 1 for the rolling papers. It's a class 1 to sell them, the cigarette. I think you're exactly right. The laws have changed, but the sentences remain. And I think that's clearly a policy, what you've raised is a policy consideration for the General Assembly to take a look at.
You've been listening to a recent legislative discussion about criminal penalties in North Carolina. Changes to those penalties would require action from the General Assembly. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Cokine. North Carolina has rebuilt its state government savings reserve. It's now roughly $1.6 billion. Is that enough? If not, how much should that reserve grow? State lawmakers are seeking help answering those questions. Stephen Bailey of the Pew Charitable Trusts recently offered ideas. Bailey focused first on North Carolina's revenue history.
You can see periods of revenue growth, like in the mid-2000s, and also periods of revenue drop, like during the Great Recession. In many ways, this line of unpredictability, or volatility, as we like to call it at Pew, is the reason for saving. And that's because imagine if you had to budget in this revenue environment without savings. Each year, your budget would be at the mercy of these revenue swings. In the good years, you would spend everything, and in the bad years, you'd have to raise taxes or cut programs just to get by. And so, in other words, your budget would be reactive to volatility.
States have different ways of coping with volatility. What separates the good ones from the bad?
The good ones have policies in law that set aside a portion of higher than normal tax revenue growth. And so what this means is that when revenues come in above a normal level, the state has a way of identifying and then saving some of that revenue. And then the second point is that they clearly identify conditions in law when reserves can be used. In other words, they have properly defined what RAIN means for the rainy day fund. And so both of these elements might seem like common sense, but we found that only 15 states are doing number one and 17 states are doing that second point.
Bailey returned to his first point.
Why is it important to save a portion of revenue when it is above normal? Well, first of all, by doing this, it prevents unreliable revenues from funding your general budget. Because think about it. Anytime you are spending at a level that is higher than your normal growth rate, you're setting yourself up for a structural imbalance. And that's because that, by definition, when tax revenue is higher than normal, then spending all of that is unsustainable. And so savings rules tied directly to that revenue growth ensure that the state is saving the most during those growth periods instead of baking it into the general budget. And second, Saving above normal revenue growth allows you to build up those reserves in the best times to use when financial stress is the greatest. In other words, it ensures your savings policy is connected directly to the ups in the business cycle. There are 15 states that currently save based on above normal tax growth. And while there's a lot of variation in those 15 states, generally those states have two things in common. One, they have a method for determining when revenue is above normal. And then two, that they define how much of that above normal revenue they want to save.
That's Stephen Bailey, senior researcher with the Pew Charitable Trusts. He pointed specifically to Virginia. That state has a rule that forces lawmakers to save half of any revenue growth that exceeds the state's six-year average. How would a similar rule apply to North Carolina?
In 4 out of the 5 years, the model recommended more money be saved than what actually happened. The model saves the most revenue when revenue is the most above normal, which is 2006. And it saves nothing in 2002 and 2008 when revenue growth is below normal. If you add up all of these years, which one had more total savings? The Virginia model saved $1.3 billion in above trend revenue, while the state actually saved $787 million over that same time period. That's a difference of $522 million. Is that good? Well, that's a tougher question. However, we know that in 2009 alone, revenues in North Carolina dropped by $2.2 billion. So it's likely that that extra savings would have been very useful during the Great Recession that followed. Also remember that that extra $522 million is now no longer baked into the general budget, meaning that during the Great Recession, that program cuts or tax increases would likely have been less severe. If you look at the same period from 2010 to 2015, North Carolina actually saved $502 million over that time, and the Virginia model would have recommended $1.1 billion in savings.
It's important to do more than just set rules in place for adding to the savings reserve account. Lawmakers need to look at the other side of the ledger.
The second key characteristic of a successful savings policy is clearly identifying conditions when savings can be used based on revenue or economic criteria. And so this means that the best states have fund withdrawal policies that allow them to access the fund only when revenue or an economic indicator, like state personal income, fall below a clear and predetermined level. North Carolina is one of only 5 states with no conditions in law for when the rainy day fund can be used, regardless of what criteria is the withdrawal condition. So does this matter? Are conditions for fund use important if North Carolina has done a relatively good job of managing its fund use over the years? And the answer, at least for us, is yes, absolutely, it matters. First, you're making sure that now and in the future, the savings reserve account is only going to be used in times of revenue or economic distress, not for a new program or not for funding an expenditure when revenue is growing. And this is vital because there are 2 problems when you use your savings during good financial times. Obviously, you will have less available during the worst economic times, but also, since you have used your savings to fund recurring costs during a growth period, you have created a structural imbalance in your budget. Withdrawal conditions tied to revenue or economic criteria promote long-term structural stability.
It's not just the Pew Charitable Trusts that likes the idea of setting clear rules in place for savings reserves.
Credit rating agencies have stressed that fund use should fit into a pattern that reinforces structural balance, with withdrawals occurring during times of economic distress. And so that underscores how important it is for states to establish in law withdrawal conditions linked to underlying volatility, because it provides a clear signal to credit rating agencies that a state's reserve policy is attentive to the business cycle.
Bailey says states like Oklahoma spend from savings only when revenue falls below certain targets. Other states, like Indiana, use the saving reserves based on economic indicators.
I went and pulled data on North Carolina's state personal income, and I'm shading in purple anytime state personal income grew by less than 2%, similar to Indiana's economic rule. And you can see that this would mean the fund would be available to use in 2002, 2008, 2009, just like the revenue rule, and in 2013.
Bailey emphasized the importance of North Carolina setting rules that work for this state.
It would be up to you to determine what revenue criteria or economic criteria is best. Maybe you'd want to cover times when revenue grows less than 2%, so you could cover that dip you saw in 1996. But that brings me to my final point on withdrawal conditions, that clearly defining when the savings reserve account can be used is a vital first step before you determine the true optimal savings target of your fund. And this is important, but that's because that the amount needed to cover all times when revenues grow less than 2% is going to be different than if you wanted to cover all times when revenue grows less than 4% or all time revenue grows less than a trend line.
So what's the best practice for state government savings reserves?
The best rainy day fund policies ensure a state is saving the most during those revenue peaks, and that is deposit rules that are tied to revenue growth. And the best rainy day fund policies also make sure that the state is only using its funds during periods of fiscal decline, and those are withdrawal rules tied to revenue or economic criteria. Both of those are policies that promote long-term budget stability and are a best practice.
That's the voice of Stephen Bailey, senior researcher at the Pew Charitable Trust. He's helping North Carolina lawmakers consider rules for building and using state government savings reserves. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ordered the North Carolina General Assembly to redraw some legislative districts. And then it has ordered the state of North Carolina to conduct special legislative elections, all of this next year, 2017. Now, the ruling has generated more questions than it has answered in the ongoing battle over the drawing of election districts in North Carolina. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She's following the story for us and joins us now. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
We just elected 170 members of the General Assembly. Yes, we've been talking about this for a very long time. 120 in the House, 50 in the Senate. So why are we talking about it again?
Redistricting. I mean, that's the magic word. And you know, what we're looking at now are these legislative maps. And a three-judge federal panel has said that some of the districts are unconstitutional. So they've got to go back and look at those. They have designated 28 of these districts. There are 19 in the House and 8 in the Senate. I think that's right.
19 in the House, 9 in the Senate.
Thank you. That need to be redrawn. They're saying that they were racially gerrymandered and they need to be redrawn. So, you know, what we have is, if you think of North Carolina as a map with all of the districts being the puzzle pieces of that, mm-hmm. when you change the parameters of one puzzle piece, it affects others. So if you're talking about, you know, 28 legislative districts that have to be redrawn, there's many others that are going to have to be redrawn. Now, I got my map out and got my marker and colored in which ones they were talking about so I could see where they were. They're mostly in the eastern part of the state. There's a few in Guilford County and a couple in Mecklenburg County. Nothing west of Mecklenburg County. So the question kind of becomes is, will the counties in the western part of the state be affected at all by this? And then how much will the counties in the eastern part of the state be impacted? How many districts are we really talking about? Will they be able to redistrict the Guilford County districts just within Guilford County and not have to go outside those county lines? Same thing in Mecklenburg. As you mentioned earlier, so there's a lot more questions that come up with this than there really are answers. But that's what we're looking at. It's always more complicated. And then the schedule that they've set out to do this with the maps due, the new maps being redrawn due in March of 2017, A primary would be held in late summer, early fall, probably September, and then have another election in November.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, here we are again.
Okay, so let me get this straight. The current session of the General Assembly begins in just a couple of weeks.
With a lot of new members,
right,
who were elected just a couple of weeks ago. Yes.
So conceivably then, does that mean that some of these new members will be having to file for potentially a primary election while they're sitting in the General
that
Assembly?
That is correct, where they've barely gotten started in the General Assembly. Now, a couple things with this that I think are really sort of peculiar. In these off-year elections that we see, and you're talking about primaries, and, you know, this is often when the turnout is in, you know, maybe 10%, maybe 4%,
right.
I mean, very, very low. The court in the order said, we recognize that doing this may result in a very low turnout election. We don't care. You have to do it anyway. Now, the other thing is, remember that legislators have to live in their district. Right now, there is a requirement that in order to file and run for a legislative seat, you have to live in your district for at least a year before the election, before I think even the filing begins. Well, in this order, the court has also said you don't have to do that for this election. You only have to live in your district on the day that filing ends. So, you know, depending on how they draw these maps, whether incumbents want to run again for a district that may have not include their residents, they are allowed to pick up residents before filing ends anywhere in the new district. So, you know, I've said before, you know, we may say this may be really good for the apartment rental business come next year.
This sounds absolutely just chaotic, frankly, and very confusing to voters. And the issue of turnout, it's got to be a big one. But yet the court went forward because
right,
they must feel that there are serious issues at play here.
Yeah, I think the important thing to note is that the General Assembly has appealed this request, and they've done a couple things. One, there's one request just to make it go away entirely. There's another one to grant a stay that would indicate that the General Assembly would have to draw new districts, but there wouldn't be an election in 2017. It would go on with the regular next two-year cycle in 2018 under newly drawn districts. So there's some options out there. What we've just described is what the order is right now. These appeals are going forward, and we'll see what happens with that. But Donna, it raises other questions too. I mean, it's confusing for voters. It's confusing for those who might choose to run for election, incumbents and new folks who might, you know, have an interest to want to run for the General Assembly. But it also raises some questions about, you know, how's the General Assembly going to work? Our General Assembly is elected for a two-year time period, and within that, they pass a two-year budget the first year of their two-year session. Well, if we're going to have a whole new election next year, that means that this 2017 General Assembly is only for a year. Do they pass a one-year budget? Do they pass a two-year budget that then the next General Assembly would be obligated to adopt? And, you know, a lot of the funding for things like that we enjoy every day, whether it's going to get our driver's license, whether it's transportation funding on improvements on the port, whether it's education funding through our court system, and local funding as well, Medicaid, a lot of the health services, a lot of those, the agencies and the people that are providing these services do it on a two-year time frame because they have a two-year budget within to work. So it's chaotic and confusing and a lot of unanswered questions from every single angle.
What are you hearing from legislators now that they've had at least a few days to kind of let all this sink in? Presumably, they're thinking the same thing that you are. My gosh, how is this going to work?
Right. And these are the conversations that we're having. I mean, they don't, you know, in search of us trying to understand it, get our hands wrapped around it, I've had many conversations with legislators, and quite frankly, they don't know any more than we do and are just as confused. What it does for their work, you know, you have to think about this too. Usually there's a two-year time period from which they are elected. So they really have that first long session that they really focus on governing and then perhaps get geared up for the campaign season. And in the second year, well, that will be compacted and they'll be getting ready for another election. So do they go in and tackle some of those really hard, heavy lifts, things that really require a lot of committee meetings, a lot of discussion, a lot of studying? You know, do they look at that or do they just go in and do what barely has to be done to get through in order to prepare for the next election? So as far as policy decisions and a lot of the things that we're working on at the John Lott Foundation, some of those things that we believe will really move the state forward, but require requires some really, you know, some heavy lift and some heavy work. Energy policy is a good example of that. Does that just get put off because this election just overwhelms everything else that they're going to do? So we don't know. We, of course, are proceeding with our recommendations of the things that need to be done in North Carolina to move it forward, regardless of what the courts may decide and what this may look like.
And politically, Becky, it makes me wonder if some of those folks who maybe lost in a primary last year or maybe were defeated in their general election this year might think, oh, this is an incredible opportunity,
of course,
to come right back in, see if they can win the second time.
And you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Right. I mean, I think more people that are involved and more different opinions that we have in these things is really valuable. And to have some turnover in the General Assembly, I think, is good. But, you know, we don't want it done where it's so confusing, nobody knows what they're doing, and it's just chaotic.
Well, as you said, this has been appealed. Right now, as you and I are talking, this order does stand that the 2017 election for some of these districts would take place and the redrawing would take place. But we'll have you back once we know more about what happens with that appeal. We've been talking with Becky Gray. She's Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. By the way, you can read all of her work at johnlocke.org, carolinajournal.com. Becky, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.